A grief-stricken Julius continued to reside in New York City, but soon he was visiting his son in California on a regular basis. Father and son grew even closer. Indeed, Robert's students and colleagues at Berkeley were rather taken by the manner in which he made room in his life for his father. During the winter of 1932, father and son shared a cottage in Pasadena where Robert was teaching that term. Robert had lunch with his father every day and took him one evening a week to an elite dinner club that met at Caltech. Robert used the German word Stammtisch, a table reserved for regular guests, for these dinners, where a designated speaker gave a presentation followed by vigorous discussion. Julius was enormously pleased to be included in these events and wrote Frank, "They are very good fun. I am meeting lots of Robert's friends, and yet I believe that I have not interfered with his activities. He is always busy and has had a couple of short talks with Einstein." Twice a week, Julius played bridge with Ruth Euling, and they became good friends. "Nobody could make a woman feel more important than the way he, Julius, could," recalled Ruth later. "He was terribly proud of his son. He couldn't understand how he had produced Robert." Julius also talked passionately about the art world, and when Ruth visited him in New York in the summer of 1936, he proudly showed her his collection of paintings. "He made me sit all day before the beautiful Van Gogh with a blazing sun to see," she recalled, "how the light changed it." Among other friends, Robert introduced his father to Arthur W. Ryder, a professor of Sanskrit at Berkeley. Ryder was a Hoover Republican and a sharp-tongued iconoclast. He was fascinated by Oppenheimer, and Robert, for his part, thought Ryder the quintessential intellectual. His father agreed. "He is an astounding person," Julius said, "a remarkable combination of austereness through which peeps the gentlest kind of soul." Robert later credited Ryder with giving him a renewed feeling for the place of ethics. "Here was a scholar," he said, "who felt and thought and talked as a Stoic." He regarded Ryder as one of those rare people who have a tragic sense of life in that they attribute to human actions the completely decisive role in the difference between salvation and damnation. Ryder knew that a man could commit irretrievable error and that in the face of this fact, all others were secondary. Robert felt himself drawn to both Ryder and the ancient language that was his friend's vocation. Soon Ryder was giving Oppenheimer private tutorials in Sanskrit each Thursday evening. "I am learning Sanskrit," Robert wrote Frank, "enjoying it very much, and enjoying again the sweet luxury of being taught." While most of his friends saw this new obsession as slightly odd, Harold Chernus, who had introduced Oppie to Ryder, thought it made perfect sense. "He liked things that were difficult," Chernus said, "and since almost everything was easy for him, the things that really would attract his attention were essentially the difficult. Besides, Oppie had a taste for the mystical, the cryptic." With his facility for languages, it wasn't long before Robert was reading the Bhagavad Gita. "It is very easy and quite marvelous," he wrote Frank. He told friends that this ancient Hindu text, the Lord's Song, was the most beautiful philosophical song existing in any known tongue. Ryder gave him a pink-covered copy of the book, which found its way onto the bookshelf closest to his desk. Oppie took to passing out copies of the Gita as gifts to his friends. Robert was so enraptured by his Sanskrit studies that when, in the autumn of 1933, his father bought him yet another Chrysler, he named it the Garuda, after the giant bird god in Hindu mythology that ferries Vishnu across the sky. The Gita, which constitutes the heart of the Sanskrit epic Mahabharata, is told in the form of a dialogue between the incarnate god Krishna and a human hero, Prince Arjuna. About to lead his troops into mortal combat, Arjuna refuses to engage in a war against friends and relatives. Lord Krishna replies in essence that Arjuna must fulfill his destiny as a warrior to fight and kill. Ever since his emotional crisis of 1926, Robert had been trying to achieve some kind of inner equilibrium. Discipline and work had always been his guiding principles, but now he self-consciously elevated these traits to a philosophy of life. In the spring of 1932, Robert wrote his brother a long letter explaining why. "The fact that discipline," he argued, "is good for the soul is more fundamental than any of the grounds given for its goodness. I believe that through discipline, though not through discipline alone, we can achieve serenity, and a certain small but precious measure of freedom from the accidents of incarnation, and that detachment which preserves the world which it renounces. I believe that through discipline we learn to preserve what is essential to our happiness in more and more adverse circumstances, and to abandon with simplicity what would else have seemed to us indispensable. And only through discipline is it possible to see the world without the gross distortion of personal desire, and in seeing it so, accept more easily our earthly privation and its earthly horror. Like many Western intellectuals enthralled with Eastern philosophies, Oppenheimer the scientist found solace in their mysticism. He knew, moreover, that he was not alone. He knew that some of the poets he admired most, like W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot, had themselves dipped into the Mahabharata. Therefore, he concluded in his letter to the 20-year-old Frank, "I think that all things which evoke discipline, study, and our duties to men and to the commonwealth, and war, and personal hardship, and even the need for subsistence, ought to be greeted by us with profound gratitude. For only through them can we attain to the least detachment, and only so can we know peace."